Okay, so we have been continuing our investigation into what exactly is the prohibition to be mazik someone's property. Not only the issue of tashlumin, which we know from the psukim and from the Mishnah, but the obligation being clear to repay, how do you know that it's usur to do it in the first place? How do you know that it's usur to damage someone's property, even if you're willing to compensate them, and even if you do that immediately? And we have assumed that there has to be some isur. We had a number of sources that indicate that way, in addition to our chush, and we discussed a couple of possibilities. Is it perhaps bal tashchis, or is bal tashchis not adequate? Is it perhaps lo sigzol, the chidushim there? Some of you spent some time looking, based on the source sheet, at the ksos and the nesivis and the like, which, just to put that in context, that follows up on that issue of the connection between mazik and gezel, and to what extent that's there. And that was essentially most of what we had seen. We mentioned how those two possibilities of bal tashchis, which the stipler didn't like, we talked about that, versus lo sigzol, one major difference between the two is, are we looking for a source that's specifically ben adam l'makom or ben adam l'chaveiro? So lo sigzol would fit into a ben adam l'chaveiro model much better. Bal tashchis, and perhaps even Derecha Darchei Noam, which the Rosh had invoked, those seem more like midos issues, which wouldn't necessarily be a ben adam l'chaveiro aspect. And we talked about how the Chiyuv Mechila would fit into that whole story, etc., etc. So one other major possibility, we'll discuss a few, is brought by the Yad Ramah in his comments to Bava Kama. The Yad Ramah is significant for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of meaty discussion in this Yad Ramah. But for our purposes, as far as an Isser Nezikin, so he traces it to two possible psukim. Well, what are those? Want to help me out? What's the source according to the Arama? Yeah. So they could be ben adam l'chaveiro ideas, presumably. V'ahavta kamocha. Okay, I see how they're linked in your mind. You know, clearly a connection between the two. So the notion of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, just to clarify a little bit of the history of that idea, I'm sure you've heard it once or twice before. It's a klal gadol b'Torah, and it's one of our more popular psukim. It has been utilized by cultures all across the world. It's also known as the Golden Rule. So it's a very beautiful idea. It has a complexity to it. It has an inherent challenge. The idea of Yahavta L'Reyacha Kamocha, translating it is difficult. And each word, actually, literally each word, there's what to try to figure out. What does Ava mean? What does Reyacha mean? What does Kamocha mean? Hello. Hi. I'm sorry? Daniel Feldman. Please. Yes. Chesed, we know, is Nechol and V'ahavta L'recha Kamocha. I think that's actually one thing we know, but it's not such a simple point, to tell you the truth. Because it goes to what we were talking about. The Rambam in Hilchos Evel, the Rambam tells us that all of chesed, all of the obligations that we have of chesed, are included in V'ahavta L'recha Kamocha. But there's an inherent challenge. Some of the other Rishonim have a difficulty with it, because all the words are hard to translate. What does Ava mean? What does Reacha mean? What does Kamocha mean? So Kamocha is the challenge here, because Kamocha suggests that it's to an equal degree. That the same way you love yourself, you should love other people. So if we understand it to mean that that is an active obligation, that you should do things for other people to the same degree as you do to yourself, for yourself, that's very, very hard to relate to. It's very hard to practice. And that's an understatement to say it's very hard. It's impossible. Right? How exactly are you going to have the resources to do everything that you do for yourself towards even one other person, let alone everybody? So to say V'ahavta l'recha kamocha is a positive obligation is very difficult. Now, nonetheless, the Rambam says it, and that's where he has all of this obligation of chesed coming from there, so you have to figure out how to translate it. There are ways to do it, but it's a challenge. So one way to address the problem is to take the attitude that it's really a negative concept, which sounds hard to accept. This is the most positive of all ideas, but maybe really it's a negative notion of, as Hillel phrases it in the Gemara in Shabbos, Ma'adalach soni l'chavrcha lo sabit, that which is hateful to you, do not do to others. Because then, it's possible. You can imagine a scenario where you can live up to that. That whatever you don't want done to you, so you shouldn't do that to someone else. That's theoretically possible. Still could be very challenging. There could be conflicts where you have to compromise this. But it's theoretically possible to live a life where you don't do things to other people that you don't want done to you. But it's not really possible to live a life where you do everything for others that you do for yourself. So that's often an understanding of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, that it plays out as if it's a lo saseh. It's what you should not do. So, for example, this is invoked in some of the literature about eavesdropping and electronic surveillance. How do you know that you can't spy on someone else, and you can't infringe on their privacy? Because V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. It's all like ironic, because you might think infringing on their privacy is too much interested in your neighbor. So V'ahavta l'recha kamocha seems like an ironic translation. But nonetheless, that the idea is that you wouldn't want it done to you, so you shouldn't do it to somebody else. So anything that's included in that kind of a consideration is addressed by V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. So could be that that's the Isser Nezikin, that you shouldn't do this because you wouldn't want it done to you. So that's a definite possibility. Rav Kook has a tshuva about this in his tshuvas, where he talks about how this should apply both to Nezikin and to Grumma B'Nezikin, which is important because here we're disconnecting it from the Chiyuv Teshlumin. Normally, if you have a situation where you don't directly damage something, but you indirectly, whatever that means, definitely, God willing, something we will get to, but is a grumma b'nezikin. So a grumma b'nezikin normally is putter. We'll discuss, God willing, there are all kinds of in-between possibilities, grumma and me, it's a whole discussion. But when you only indirectly cause something to be damaged, so that starts off as a patur. But it's still prohibited. The assumption is that whatever the Isser of Nezikin is, it includes Grum of a Nezikin. It could be, by the way, that Lashon Hara is considered to be parallel to Grum of a Nezikin, that when you talk badly about people and you cause them to lose out, you cause them to suffer, so it's not actionable in Beis Din, you can't be forced to pay for that because it's a grama, and we don't have a chiyuv of restitution for Lashon Hara, but it's still causing them problems. So that might be all under this heading of grama b'nezikin. So grama b'nezikin, you're not going to be obligated to pay, at least on an absolute deraisa level, but it's still usur. Sammy had a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask this. Doesn't that sort of, doesn't Grumman and Nezikin sort of make us risk broadening the scope too much for Nezikin in general?
What do you mean?
I'm just saying, we view them as two different things. I mean, especially given that Brahman and the Zikin, you're usually bothering
them. So you say, how can we connect them as far as the Isser?
So
the details of Grom and Zeke and God willing, we'll get to go into a little bit more. But as far as being included under the same prohibition, it's provocative to think about it just far how far that goes. But it certainly makes sense. You know, it could be that like other situations, other areas of halacha, so you have a broader isser than you have consequences. So sometimes you have, let's say in Hilcha Shabbos, situations where there are things that you're pater abal aser. So maybe it's all the same isser, and for grama you're pater. So Rav Kook writes that when you're dealing with a grama ben azikin, or you're dealing with a hezek she'ena nikr, right, let's say you cast some spiritual defect on somebody's property. So now they can't use it, but if you look at it, it's still the same item, it's still intact. It's a hezek she'eino nikr. So Rav Kook writes that all of these should be included under v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Those are all prohibited for that reason. And he goes on to note that a consequence of that being the isser is that theoretically there could be exceptions. That we're saying treat others like you treat yourself. So then what if it were your item, you would decide that better to sacrifice this item for some greater benefit. So if that were the situation, that you could make that calculus on behalf of someone else, that they will benefit more from having this item sacrificed than from not doing that, and you would have made that decision for yourself, then maybe there's no Isser Lahazik in that case. Which is an interesting perspective. Now, he also notes that you can't mix and match here. You can't say that, if I'll be happier if I'm Mazik your stuff, so then I should be able to do it. I take my V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha so literally that it would help me to be Mazik your stuff, so therefore I can do it. But if I were you, I would want to trade what I have now, sacrifice what I have now for some larger purpose. So he writes in Achanami that wouldn't necessarily be awesome. So that's a major possibility, that the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha is the driving Isser, so to speak, despite its positive tone, that it's the source of the Isser. That's definitely a possibility as well. Hi.
What's this example of a Hezek Shehina?
So let's say if you put some truma into somebody else's the commissioner talks about in Gittin, if you make it usher to non kohanim, if you create some kind of chalos isser on their property, so then it looks the same, but they can't use it. So then you tame it. Time is a question. So then that's considered to be a hezek, even though it doesn't have any fundamental physical change.
Do we assume that the Ahavta would cover property? In my short?
Yeah, because, so once you say that, so that's an interesting question, you know, why should we necessarily say that your responsibilities also include the liability that connects to your property doing something? So that's going to require a few more steps. We'll see how they come together. But for now, it's not so hard to say, because you'd say just like you would want your neighbor to keep his wild dog chained up and not go after you, so too you should keep your wild dog chained up and not have it go after you. Now the idea, the idea, it's also mentioned here, of Lufne'iver. Lufne'iver is an interesting prohibition itself. Also appears there in Parshas Kedoshim. Lufne'iver, just a little mini hakdama to that. So Lufne'iver has three components to it, at least. And when we talk about the Isser Lufne'iver L'Sitein Michshol, so we most commonly talk about what's probably the third level of interpretation. That if you help someone to sin, that if somebody has a weakness towards an avera, and you provide them the wherewithal to commit that avera, So the Gemara says in a few places, but Azara and elsewhere, that that's a violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. So that we have a tradition from Chazal that that's included. But the more literal translation is simply that you are putting a stumbling block in front of someone who can't see, and therefore they are going to hurt themselves. And there's another interpretation. The Gemara also mentioned if you give somebody bad advice. So we have basically three manifestations of that Isser. And there's an interesting discussion to be had about whether those are all one and they just have different arenas in which they come up, or those different interpretations that we have Torah Shebaal Peh that tells us that there are different levels here. Hi. Absolutely. So we will get to that forthwith, or at least fifthwith, but soon. So this notion of Lifnei Iver, even though we relate to it more in terms of the actual causing someone to sin, the Mechas Chinuch has a discussion, says that some understand that if you put a literal rock in front of a literal blind person, that it's not Lifnei Iver, because Lifnei Iver, we only understand it in terms of these extra interpretations. That's less likely, as he discusses there. So Pashtus, you cause somebody to trip, that's also Lifnei Iver. So you have a dangerous situation. Either yourself or your property cause a michshol for people. So maybe that's also included within Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. And the Meshech Chachma writes over there on the Pasuk that if you do it in public, like a boar, so then that is Lifnei Iver. If it's private, if it's in your house, so then that's a violation of Lo Sasim Damim B'Veisecha, a technicality in terms of what Pasuk is relevant. Okay, so these are also theoretically possible. Yes, sir?
So there's no issue of extending the pshat of the Pasuk because we don't know which one is pshat.
Right, so presumably it's not an issue. Presumably that's what the Pasuk also means, that causing people to trip up is, and there he uses the more extreme version, the person is completely blind, but it could mean anybody who's not aware of what is in front of them is subject to this. In general, if you want to say, and this is a fascinating topic to pursue, which is completely tangential, but if you want to explore it, so the whole idea of causing someone to sin and including that in Lifnei Iver, it might be that that's not really a different interpretation, but maybe what the Torah is saying is understood in a very general way, that any time you cause somebody to stumble by exploiting their weakness, whether it's spiritual weakness or whether it's knowledge weakness, they get bad advice from you, or it's a physical weakness, they can't see what's in front of them. So all of that is subject to this prohibition of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. So maybe that's relevant here also. That could be. Now there is a fascinating tshuva of the Chasam Sofer that draws on some of these psukim and really opens up yet another aspect of how, as we keep highlighting, this sugya is just a broad introduction to all different inyanim of societal responsibility. So here the Chasam Sofer and his tshuva has a fascinating perspective. And he uses it to explain the Rashba. You'll recall, we mentioned the Rashba yesterday. That I think we mentioned yesterday, the day before, that the Rashba says that even though you would think that a suffik, in the case of Nezikin, should be lakula, if we're talking about the Teshlumen, so if we don't know what the rule is, we say, Hamotze mechavero olav haraya, somebody who's coming to collect, the burden's on you if you're collecting, and the person who's defending, he has the advantage. But the Gemara didn't sound that way in terms of Karen, and the Rashba indicated that what you have here is a Safek Isser. And that was one of the sources we pointed to of there being a prohibition. So the Chassam Sofer has a fascinating truth about this. Hi. Yeah, the Gemara is a little bit of a complicated case. The Gemara was talking about just figuring out what the Chi of Karen is. That is, the Chi of Karen only when the ox lunges with the Karen between its teeth, or does it apply when its Karen is still attached, the Mechuberes? So the Gemara implies that we need a Pasuk to make it clear, because we may have thought the two cases would have been different, and we wouldn't know what the story is if it was attached. And the language of the Gemara is Ema Kula Muadas. We would have thought that it's all under the category of Muad. So the Rashba asks, why would I have thought that? That's a greater level of obligation. I should have thought the opposite if I don't know, by default. So this more Chumer interpretation, he says, because there is an Isser involved. So it says the Chassam Sofer, this is in some Reish Mem Aleph and Chosh Mishpat, I believe. Says the Chassam Sofer, the Torah is worried that here we have values of keeping people safe, of Nishmartem La'od L'Nafsho Seichem, and Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, that we can't stand idly by when people are at risk. So we need to have a environment where people are protected, where people are going to be safe, and you don't have to worry that others are going to allow their property to be dangerous to other individuals. So how does the Torah make sure that that's going to happen? So it says Chassam Sofer, it's a fascinating idea, that the Torah is going to do that by creating a obligation to pay. That if there is a chiyuv of Teshlumin, if you know that if your property in any of the categories that we have, any of the Avos Nezikin, if your property inflicts damage either on someone else's property or on their person, you know you're going to be liable. So then that will help create a safer environment, because nobody's going to want to have to pay out all the bills that they're going to have to pay for damages. So once there is a chiyuv tashlumei nezikin, so people are going to memela, are going to be more careful with their stuff. Yes, sir. Maybe.
There
well,
need to be an Isser if you have something else to rectify what you did.
Well, it's interesting. We'll have to see how this also dovetails with some other ideas, saying that we clearly have a value that we're supposed to be creating a safe environment. And he's highlighting this psukim of Nishmartem Ola Nafsho Seichem, Lo Samar Ola Dam Re'echa. He says those where you have the mitzvah values. And together that creates a picture where you should not have people put in danger. So how do we also make sure that people aren't put in danger? That if not only do we tell you to be careful, but we give it some bite, right? We say that if someone does get hurt, you're going to be liable. So that's not only as a restitution, but that's also as a corrective, which is a fascinating idea. And again, it's one of the additional directions that the sugya takes us in terms of our communal responsibility. And basically, it comes out as a deterrent rather than as restitution.
Wouldn't we want to see maybe a different, if that comes up anywhere else? Like, I know that Tzadon cannot say that.
Right, so we'll see that when it comes to Tzror or something like that, or Tam. Right, there are some situations where we could have a knas as a possible category. Right, it could be that's true by a short tam. It could be that's true by garmi, we alluded to before. Right, that it could be that there are situations where technically you are pater because it's too indirect, but nonetheless, Chazal were still concerned that we can't let people off the hook for these kind of situations because there's some degree of liability. So, in general, it's going to be a discussion what's mammon and what's knas. So that's, was Rav Shechter gave a hakdama to the Masechta on Sunday. Was anyone there? I think you maybe spoke about some of these issues. But we know in general when it comes to payments, so we have that which is called mammon, we're saying that which is called knas. So mammon generally means that there is a real world connection between what you're paying and how you incurred that liability. So if I borrow money, I have to pay you back. That's mammon. If I damaged your property, I damaged you $100 worth of damage, so I have to pay you $100. That's mammon. But if it doesn't exactly correlate, if it's more or perhaps if it's less than any real world damage, so that's often knas, meaning that it doesn't mean you're paying back an actual dollar sum that reflects a real world impact, but that this is something that the Torah is penalizing you for. So when it comes to Nezikin, so clearly it's mammon, but as far as its purpose here, we're seeing maybe that it has a knas-like purpose, that making you liable for the mammon that you are causing, that's a way to make society safer. That if we put you on the hook, so you're going to be more careful not to allow these situations to take place. So really a very interesting idea. And what also emerges from the Chasam Sofer's tshuva is that it serves a purpose beyond this, right? Because we're also really worried about people dying. We're worried about people's safety. So even though we're focusing here on property damage, but making you liable for the property damage is a way of ensuring that all the dangerous elements are addressed, and therefore the bigger problems of people actually being hurt or dying is also going to benefit because we have a safer society. So therefore, he understands in that context the Rashba, because he's viewing it not just as, okay, it's a suffix, mammon, if I damage you, so maybe I have to pay, and you have to prove how much I have to pay. But it's like a suffix iser, because essentially the fact of you paying is the tool by which we enforce the mitzvah not to hurt someone, or not to hurt their property. So therefore, the better framework is not, okay, this is an after-the-fact teshlumen, but it's there to keep you from causing damage in the first place, and that's how he understands the Rashba, that Suffolk L'chumra is the better framework. Okay, makes sense? It's a fascinating perspective. So one of the psukim that he invokes is Lo Samad Al Dam Re'echa. Lo Samad Al Dam Re'echa was also invoked by Rav Soloveitchik in one of the issues of the Masorah Journal. You know, that's the journal that's published by the OU, which is about half about Kashrus, and the first half is Torah of Rav Soloveitchik. So in one of the issues of the Masorah Journal many years ago, there was a piece about this Issur L'Hazik question. And Rav Soloveitchik is quoted there as saying that he thinks that it is included in the concept of Lo Samad Al Dam Re'echa. Because Lo Samad Al Dam Re'echa, literally, if you translate it, it sounds like it means that you should not stand idly by when someone's at risk of death. Al Dam Re'echa. But if you look in the Rambam, in the Sefer HaMitzvos, when the Rambam applies this concept, so you'll see that he's more expansive, and that damim, we know, has multiple meanings. So damim means blood, it sounds like someone's life. It also means money. We talk about damim to mean money. So the Rambam understands it both physically and materially, and to any degree. It doesn't just mean that somebody is at risk of dying, but if somebody is at risk of getting hurt, so all of that is included in Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha. So you cannot stand idly by, not only if someone's going to get killed, but if somebody is at risk of being harmed, or if their property is at risk of being harmed, so you can't stand idly by. And as the Gemara indicates, that means that if you see someone, their property is at risk, you see that they left their laptop next to, left it out on the street, and it's about to rain, and you can bring it in from the rain, so you're obligated to do that. You shouldn't stand by and let it get drenched, but you should bring it in and protect it. So, said Rav Soloveitchik, a question about that?
It's just also, maybe interesting, maybe it's not interesting at all, but it still looks at that. Also.
Right. So. Right, so does that change the... Does that change the makeup of it?
The only asset that we saw was maybe if you have to, but we even shifted that to also be a Los Asse.
Right. But we like one Los Igzal, we would like it to be a Los Asse.
Why is that better?
Just if we're assuming an Isser, so then to put it in the category of some prohibition would seem to make a little more sense. But it doesn't have to. Hi.
How far do they take that? Does someone have to take a loss to
So no, presumably not, and we'll talk about that a little more in a second in a different context. But just parenthetically, there's a lot of discussion about where to go with this because... And you know, each one of these topics could branch out into it, so, but we'll just touch it for a second. Well, Samar al Dam Re'acha has a lot of implications, and the Achronim actually struggled with it because since it's a Los Asse, as Mar was pointing out, so it should have really pretty heavy obligations. So it's a question: why don't we say, for example, Achiezer struggled, Reb Chaim Ozer struggled, there's others discussed this question that. If for Los Asse, you have to give up all of your money, so let's say somebody comes to you and they're collecting for a person who needs surgery, and it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. So maybe we should say that you should be obligated to give all your money, because if they're going to die otherwise, and it's Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, so then maybe it's without limits. Some suggest, Chaim Ozer talks about this also, that maybe we shouldn't really classify it as a Los Asse, because maybe we should classify these things as, and this actually also connects to what Mori was saying, that maybe we should view Los Asse's and Asse's based on whether you're passive or active, regardless of the language of the Pasuk. So we should say, Los Amar Adam Re'acha, it's referring to something passive, right, to stand by. So, Amida means to just parenthetically here, you want a tangent. So I remember for Purim when I was in Yeshiva in Israel, I wanted to write a sefer for Purim that you know, Rav Yosef Engel has a few svarim where he has 70 or 80 terutzim to a certain question. So for Purim, I once wanted to write about zestira, that in expressions in English, that if somebody insults you, so you say, I'm not going to take that sitting down. So mashma, you should stand up. But sometimes if somebody insults you, you say, I'm not going to stand for that. Mashma, you should sit down. So which is it? You should sit down, you should stand up. So I was collecting terutzim from people. Some thought it was a difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Some thought it was it's a sman, Hilchas Edus, that talks about when the dayan has to sit and the edim have to stand. But what if you're leaning? It's all relative. There's a bunch of answers. So the real answer is it's really a tosis in Brachos, because the Gemara in Brachos talks about how the beginning of Kriya Shema, even though you can be walking around when you're saying Kriya Shema, v'lechtecha baderech, but for the beginning, the Gemara says, ad kan ba'amida. So Tosfos asks, what do you mean ba'amida? You don't have to stand up for Kriya Shema. We know you can say Kriya Shema sitting down. And Tosfos explains that no, amida there doesn't mean standing up. It means standing still. It means that if you're walking, you should stand still. So that's the teretz of that question also, that I won't stand for this doesn't mean that I'll sit down. It means you won't be still. It means you're gonna do something. So that's pshat in the pasuk here also. Lo samod al dam reyecha. You're saying that you can't be idle. You have to move. So is that viewed as a lo sasei or an asei? So the language is a lo sasei, lo samod. But maybe we don't view these things by language. Maybe we view it by the result. If you're going to be passive, that's how you're going to violate it. So then it's considered to be like a mitzvah sasei. Lo samod al dam reyecha is actually a mitzvah sasei saying do something. Hasn't been published yet. You know, it's dealing with all the bids, competing bids. There's just too much of an interest in it. But in any event, so the notion of whether this pasuk is an asay or a los asay, so it would have the nafkamina of, do you have to spend only a fifth of your money or all of your money? But it's still not going to fully answer the question, because you don't have people ready to give a fifth of their money when somebody comes and asks for tzedakah. So that question requires more of a careful answer. But normally it's a passive mitzvah, whether it's a los asay or an asay. But here, as Rav Soloveitchik points out, so it doesn't make sense to say that if your laptop is about to get rained on, I have to bring it in and save it. But if I decide I want to go and pour water on it, so I'm allowed to do that. So it seems like it's a clear kal v'chomer that if I can't just sit and watch it get rained on, so then certainly I can't be the one to soak it. So it would seem like there is a clear kal v'chomer if there's a chiyuv hatzala, so then there certainly should be an iser to be the one causing the problem. So this is very similar logic, and this is going to take a different approach though to what Yasu was asking, to what the Stipler does say. The Stipler, after not liking the approach of Baal Tashchis and after going through some of the other approaches that we've mentioned, so ultimately what the Stipler thinks is the correct approach. Remember my first day in Karen Biavner, we learned Baba Kama then, and Rav Blachman gave a shiur about this. He did not like the Stipler's approach. But the approach that the Stipler does like is Hashava Saveda, because there you have a very similar dynamic, as the Gemara says also, that you are obligated to return somebody's property that is lost, meaning misplaced, but also if it's going to be lost, meaning destroyed, you see something that's going to happen to it, and you can stop it from getting lost, from being destroyed, so then you're chayev to stop it. Now here, the Stipler goes in specifically to the issue that we were trying to zero in on here, that not only are you not allowed, what's the question we've been asking from the first minute here? Right, we understand that you can't be mafsid somebody money. You can't destroy their property in a way that's going to leave them at a disadvantage. But what if you're ready to cover it? Right, that's the question we've been most interested in. What if you're ready to pay for it? Speaking of which, right? So you're mazik amanas l'shalim. So the Stipler says, here's where you see that that's a problem too, from the halachas of hashava saveda. Why? Because to go to Yossi's question, what if the hashava saveda effort is going to cost you money? It's going to consume your property, or it's going to make you lose your income. So if it costs more for you than you are saving for the other guy, so then you are exempt. So asks the Stipler, why is it only if it costs more for you than you're saving for the other guy? What if it's the same? Right, let's say you're going to lose the exact amount that this item is worth. So then you would think it doesn't really make sense either for you to do it. Because you have the right to ask the loser, no offense to him, it's a technical term, the loser to pay you back for what you incurred. So if that's the case, so you're going to end up with a wash here. Because what's the point? Let's say he loses a $100 item and it's going to cost you $100 to save it. So you'll come to this guy and you'll say, good news, I saved your $100 item. Your $100 item. By the way, here's a bill for $100 for what it cost me to do that. So if your bill would have been $200, okay, so that's what the Gemara says, it's not kedai to do. But even if it's not more, if it's the same, it seems like it's not kedai to do. How are you helping this guy if you return his item and then bill him for the exact value of the item because that's what it costs you to save it? So based on that, says the Stipler, that's going to show you that it's not just the monetary value that we're interested in. That Hashavas Aveda is really about the item itself. It's not about just returning, keeping them on bank account equivalents. It's about the Chefza. Which opens up also all kinds of other interesting issues. That Hashavas Aveda may itself not be about momenos, may be about other things. For example, the question that Achronim ask, that the Torah says that if somebody comes to claim the lost property, so you have to ask them for proof, you have to ask them for simanim. And the Pnei Yeshu and others raise the question, well, why does he have to prove it? Al pi the laws of Dinei Mamonos, he should win. Because we have a rule of Bari Vishama, Bari Adif. Two people are disagreeing, and one person is sure, and the other person isn't sure. So we often give the advantage to the Bari, the person is sure. So when you're holding on to some property that you found, and somebody comes and tells you, listen, I'm telling you it's mine. So why don't we say, okay, so he's sure it's his. And I don't know that it's not his. It could be. So why don't we say Bari Vishama, that we should advantage the guy who's claiming it. So it could be that this doesn't follow the rules of Mamonos. That's how some of the Achronim understand. So it could be that Hashavas Aveda is not just about keeping the person monetarily complete, but it's about this object, that you're supposed to save the object and give it back to the person. And it's just that if it's going to be financially illogical, so then you're potter. But as long as it's a wash, even, you're going to come out the same, then you're still obligated to do it. So if that's the case, and we also want to say that from a Shavas Aveda perspective, you have to return it, so Kal Vachomer, you can't be the person causing the loss. So once we say that you have to return an item, even if it means that the owner is going to have to pay the equivalent amount and come out no better financially, so too, plug in the math, if you're going to damage the item, even if you're going to compensate him, you still are not allowed to do that. Jed, did you have your hand up before?
Yeah, I just want to ask, why is it that it is, why exactly is it about the Chafetz? Like, is it a sentimental thing? It
doesn't seem like it's sentimental. It seems like it's an interesting question to explore, why Hashavas Aveda seems to transcend the monetary issues. It could be that that's the Gzeres HaKatzar, this past week's parasha, that a person should have his property restored to him, maybe because of its potential use or whatever it is, but it seems like it's not just about mamonos. So here, that's what this chiddush is, the Stipler is saying, that even if it comes out even, you're still supposed to do it. You're not saving the guy a cent, but still you have the mitzvah anyway. It's only when you're going to cost him, he's going to have to pay you back more than his value. Okay, then we say it doesn't make sense to do. But if he comes out having to pay the whole thing, but at least his item is saved, there's still a value. So then, Mimela, if you're going to pay for the loss, you are still you're still not allowed to do it. Hi.
Is there an understanding that when you're when you pick up an object to return it, so you have a chalos of kiva shava, you're also koneda someone?
Well, you have an obligation of shmira. You don't acquire it then.
There's no degree of kinyan.
Not yet. I mean, when you steal something, sometimes there is a kinyan depending on the circumstances. But for Hashava to pick up an aveda, so
Hashava alone is not going
to
make me
right. Not to make you a violent. Okay. So here, yeah, just to assess time, we have a few minutes left now. There are a few other theories, but maybe I'll give you a little bit clearer makoros in terms of finding some of them. So we'll just fast forward for a minute, and then maybe next time that we tomorrow is going to be our first experiment in a new parsha format. But then after that, we come back to this. Maybe we'll still say a few more words about this. But there is a whole different model here, and we'll just introduce this before coming back to it. And that is a point that is raised by Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz in his shiurim called Birka Shmuel, and Bava Kamen Simon Beis quotes from his Rabbi Reb Chaim Brisker that maybe the source actually is in Parshas Mishpatim. You have to look more carefully. Maybe it actually is included in the psukim that we had on the list at the very beginning, right? We, if you recall, so from a few days ago, you saw the psukim in Mishpatim, and we said the psukim don't include any explicit isser. They just include a discussion of liability. So, is it possible to see from within those psukim maybe a source of an isser as well? Or something that's close to an isser. So says Reb Chaim, quoted by Reb Baruch Ber, that perhaps, yes, that you find in the discussion there the language of V'lo Yishmerenu Bailov. That the individual has damaging elements among his property, and he did not do anything about it. He did not protect it. So maybe essentially what the Torah is saying is that you have a chiyuv shmira when it comes to your possessions. And if you fail in that area, you don't actually practice the Shmira, so then it's the lack of Shmira that is the cause of your Hischaivus. So it's not necessarily phrased as an Isser, but as a mitzvah to maybe go beyond an Isser, right? And to say that you have to make sure that not only do you not actively damage, but even passively, the things that are part of your estate that could cause harm, you have to make sure that that doesn't happen, and then kal vachomer certainly not to actively do it. Sammy?
Just to touch on that for a second, if you're saying that you failed to successfully do the Shmira, what is the consequence? What is the direct consequence of that? We're going to say that's the...
Your liability.
Okay.
Right, but it would mean in kal vachomer, certainly you can't do it yourself. Now here, another one of the Talmidim of Reb Chaim, Rebbe Zalman Meltzer, and the Evan HaAzel, and Hilchos Nizkei Mamon, so he essentially understands from the Rambam that what's going on here is that the Torah equates your mammon to you. So when your mammonos damage something, it is as if you did the damage. And it's simply that when you do the adequate shmira, so then that gets you off the hook because it's as if it was an onus. It was as if it happened against your will. Now that's still going to get complicated because we're going to see it's not clear that an onus actually is a ptur for Adam HaMazik, and we'll have to see then how that equation plays out. But this idea that it's a ke'en and onus, so that's something which I think President Berman alluded to on Monday, and maybe that's one of the possible svaras here, that maybe it's what you are doing, it's considered as if you're doing it, but if you do adequate shmira, so then what more could you be asked to do? Hi.
I just have two questions on that. So when you're saying that like the mamonos is causing the damage, is that actual money or it could be something that you own?
Your property. We probably, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's hard for dollar bills to do such damage, but...
No, I was going to say it was... Yeah, no, obviously...
Well, you never know. I mean, harder coins, I guess. Throw them at people. But
sure,
sorry? If you drop a penny off the Empire State Building.
But an offshore is...
Right, your property, anything that's yours is considered to be mamono. So that's an interesting angle here also, the idea of that the bittul shmira that essentially makes you liable. Or B'zalman Nechemya Goldberg Shlita has an article in which he discusses the whole concept of Adam Mu'ad La'olam Ben Shogeg Ben Mezid, that we say that a person who's mazik is liable for his actions even if he's a shogeg. So it's an interesting concept because normally b'chalot Torah kula, shogeg is normally putter. So why is a shogeg liable for Adam HaMazik? So he explains that because the nature of the tashlumen is not because of what you did, it's because of your negligence. It's because you failed to prevent it from happening. So, for example, what's the case of Adam B'mazik B'shogeg? Let's say somebody has a priceless Chinese vase and you decide to go to sleep next to it. So while you're asleep, you toss and you turn and you stretch and you break the vase. So why are you liable for that? You were not conscious, you didn't do it on purpose.
It was there first,
right? So you're sleeping next to it is an act of negligence. And in fact, Yerushalmi discusses that what happens if you go to sleep first and somebody put it there after you're asleep, so then that may not be the case. So the notion that you have this liability that emanates from your negligence, from your lack of shmira, seems to be a operative factor here. Okay, so we want to still add a few thoughts to this. We'll still add a little bit more, but maybe we'll go to Menachem in a second. So let's just quickly recap what we covered today. We went through quite a few possibilities. So we discussed, as the Ad Ramah says, V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha, as a possibility. And we went through the whole question of why V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha is viewed as a lo sase, essentially, as a negative, even though it's phrased positively. But why the challenges of translating it may push us to the negative formulation of ma'adalach sani l'chavrcha lo savid. And we talked about Rav Kook's tshuva, about how this covers not only the issur nezikin in the case of where you're liable, but also cases where you're not liable, such as hezek se'ein nikar and grama b'nezikin, and could also have the consequence that if it were your property, you might make the decision that better to break this and have some other benefit, then that might be true for someone else's property also. But you can't mix and match and say it's better for me to break his stuff, but if you were him, then it would work. And then we discussed also the implications of Lifnei Iver and the different meanings of Lifnei Iver, and Lashon Chachma's point about in public Lifnei Iver and in private Lo Sasim Damim. And then we talked about the Chassam Sofer's fascinating tshuva about how the Chiyuv Tashlumin is there to make sure that people create a safe environment, and that's why the Rashba sees it as a Safik Isser, because essentially the Tashlumin itself is there to prevent these sakanas from happening. And then we talked a little bit also about Lo Samad al Damriyacha, which he mentions the Chsam Sofer of Salvechik realizes it differently, based on the notion that it covers all physical and material damage to any degree, and therefore if you're not allowed to create the damage, you can't stand by for the damage, so then Kavachomer, you can't be the one creating the damage. And there was a similar approach from a different context that the Stiplish suggested, that Hashav Saveda is the nature of the Chiyuv, because if you're obligated to stop damage from happening, then it would seem that you can't be the one to create the damage. And even Amanas L'Shalem, because we find by Hashav Saveda that you're exempt if you're going to have to bill the guy for more than the value of the item, but apparently not if you're billing him for the actual value of the item that corresponds to your losses. So what's the point of doing that? So apparently there is a point of doing that saving the chefta is the mitzvah, even if it's not going to profit the owner at all, because he's going to end up having to pay out the actual cost. And we talked also then about Reb Aruch Ber's citation of Reb Chaim, the pasuk that actually is here in Mishpatim of Lo Yishmer and Abaylov, that maybe what the Torah is saying is, oh, you had an obligation of Shmira, and if you fail to do the Shmira, so now you are saddled with the consequences of paying for it. And how that could also explain, we mentioned Mrs. Zalman and this Gemam, and how it's basically considered as if you're doing it yourself, just that there is a Ptur if you do the Shmira. And Zalman Nechemi's point about why should you be chayiv b'shogeg for your damages, unless we understand that it's not like other areas in the Torah where it's saying, oh, you did something wrong, you're chayiv, but it goes earlier than that you're obligated to protect the situation, and failing to protect the situation is going to make you liable, even if at the time when you perform the damage you're not actually a conscious individual. Okay, so we will stop there in Daf Mincha, and God willing, I'll have a little bit more to add to this point, and then to move into the Mishnah itself.